Longtime fans of the show should be familiar with the lender formerly known as Sue Pullen, and I'm pleased to announce that she's back, fresh off a rebrand and ready to help as Sue Mackey. Sue is a certified mortgage advisor at Fairway Independent Mortgage, an equal housing lender who focuses on finding the right product for you and your needs. She has over 20 years of experience helping thousands of homeowners. Whether it's purchasing, refinancing, or even a reverse mortgage, Sue will help. Sue's licensed in 36 states now, so reach out and let Sue Mackey it happen for you. The best way to reach her is just give her a call at 520-977-7904 or in an email, spullen@fairwaymc.com. Fairway Independent Mortgage has an MLS number of 2289. Sue Mackey has an MLS number of 206048. That email again, spullen@fairwaymc.com. And that phone number is 520-977-7904. Shoot Sue an email and let her know she needs to update that address.
Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Disclaimer time. This is where I tell everyone to lighten up. It's just a podcast. Trading is like that roller coaster at the amusement park. Thrilling, unpredictable, and potentially stomach churning. What works for one person might leave another clutching their hat in the wind. Our hosts and guests, they're awesome, knowledgeable, full of insights, but we're not financial advisors. So don't rush to make any investment decisions based solely on our banter. Always consult with a professional or do your own research. Plus, let's face it, we like to have fun, laugh, enjoy the trading ride together. It's all in the name of good podcasting fun. So remember, take it easy, don't bet the farm, and keep your seatbelts on at all times. Thank you for listening. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 4 of our ongoing mini-series, Informal Economics for Traders. Eric Mason, the informal economist, is our esteemed and sometimes whimsical professor. And today I'm flying solo as Mr. Banks is celebrating their newest edition. Last time we focused on labor economics, employment trends, and wage analysis and their impact on market sectors. And I think we had a really long segue into the concept of minimum wage as a whole. That was the past, though. In the present, we'll be looking at translating international news into investable decisions through applying economics to them. And I've also been promised a discussion on international public policy, currency, and public policy. Sorry, I wrote that wrong. Currency and interest rates. I might have to leave that in too.
I would be so supportive of that. First off, congratulations, Mr. Banks.
Tell me about your international public policy.
Yes. HR?
Before we do any of that, though, a quick reminder that if you do have any questions, comments, or any overdue homework assignments, you can send them our way either by Discord or email at bandoftraderspodcast@gmail.com. Eric, you got anything going on this month people can catch you at?
Yeah. So I got a couple things. One, we're going to have, I think it should be up online. You can get it. I was on the keynote panel for CFO Brew's first annual conference in New York on May 2nd, but they're doing they'll have that all up. I love CFO Brew. I'm a huge fan of them. I had to run across. First off, I hate LaGuardia.
Yeah.
I had to walk a mile. I know we were texted during that. I had to walk like a mile from my gate to the end of the terminal.
I had a similar experience in Dallas before I learned about the tram system. The little trams are so nice.
Yeah. Dallas is a huge airport. Oh, God. Yeah, so I had to run across Rockefeller Square to get over to like where they're recording it. Rockefeller Square, overrated, man.
China, overrated. I went to Times Square. We stayed there. That was pretty overrated too, unless you like drunken Elmos.
I have that. That was awesome. Like, you know, Jamie Kidd and all those guys over there, Drew Amarak. Like, it was a blast. They put on that was their first in person. It was a great time. had a lot of fun. Talked about I talked about Quincy doing the first blockchain based bond issuance in the U.S. I know Kyle, we got a conversation between you, I, and Rick.
We had a great one
right now. If anybody wants to go listen to it,
I'll make sure I link that in the episode description too. The CFO brew one, is that going to be on YouTube or is it like a podcast kind of thing?
Yeah, so they have like a recording. You have to go through their website to have it because they do like it's kind of cool, man. So like CFO Brew, which is part of the Morning Brew newsletter, they have one, you know, just for finance people. And I really recommend it, even if you're not like on the financial operations side, like a CFO, it's great to know all these little markets. But they have like a almost like a university where they have all these different recordings and stuff. It's a fun time. It was a fun time. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'll make sure to link that. Let's see. Questions too. Tell me you got a few of them from the last episode. You want to start with yours? I got one too for us.
Okay, so I got a few. Some of them are just, I want to read the mean one. Not the mean one. Like the one that gave me a good chuckle. He goes, hey, Eric, let's say I'm a day trader who skipped all my economic classes to watch just to watch stock tickers. Could you explain how knowing something about labor economics might stop me?
Might stop you from what?
Might stop me. Like, I love it. I don't know how to answer that question, and I he signed it afterwards, so like it's not like the email cut off.
Oh right, yeah. Like just didn't finish the thought.
Yeah, or that was his thought. And I think if I'm gonna take it at face value, I kind of love it. Makes him sound like an evil supervillain. Like, how can labor economics stop me?
You're familiar with the police force.
Yeah. I mean, there's that. I mean, physical people are labor. I mean, like, if I get Brock Lesnar to prevent you from hitting the trade function on, like, your portfolio, I think that's one way to stop you. But I think this kind of goes back to what we talked about, which is that, like, labor markets are inherently kind of these confusing, seen as like secondary to a lot of trading action, but they can be really beneficial. Like I think we talked about using geospatial analysis with labor markets to see how, like, if you look at labor quotient in major areas around, you know, major tech hubs, agglomeration, we call it, by seeing those things pivot up and down. I think right now you're seeing with U.S. Steel. Now, Kyle, you know this a lot better than I do, but you're seeing with, like, in steel, like there's not enough people with those skill sets to run the major steel facilities where the steel plants are. So when you have like physical capital around an investable asset, yeah, sure, you're investing in it sitting in Seattle or Austin or wherever you're sitting, but you can actually look at those individual labor markets. Labor markets are always local. Every labor market is local. So looking at those local effects can actually help you with your portfolio. I mean, if you see that like U.S. Steel, which I think is going to Nippon Steel has been making a move to buy it. Well, like if you're looking at it and you're like, oh wow, they don't have enough electricians, they don't have enough people to run these facilities right now because there's a dearth in that type of labor. That should be part of your day trading and part of your trading ethos is to say like, hey, you know, you need labor to make this work. And if there's not that labor around there, you can have enough steel workers in America, but if none of them are actually around the facility that is related to that specific company, That can be a challenge.
I mean, I think the point is that a lot of this information doesn't give you necessarily tradable, actionable insights necessarily, but it helps you paint the broader picture. Like maybe there's some industries that you don't want to trade to the long side because there's just too many things out there that scare you away from it, or, you know, it's things like that.
I couldn't agree more, Kyle. I could not. I think you're right on.
Yeah, it's all about confluence and having things all pointing the same direction. The more things you can stack in your favor, the better your trades will be.
I think labor is one of those chips that's on the table.
That speaking of the steel industry, actually, the shortage of skilled labor has been ongoing ever since I started working in the steel industry, and that was in 2008. So that's not a new problem for them.
What?
Yeah.
Wait, so this has been going on for like almost an entire...
Over a decade.
That's 16 years.
Yeah.
What the
heck? I've always had trouble finding skilled labor. Either mechanics a little easier to find, but electricians have always been difficult. We've always been shorthanded every plant I've worked at.
You know, that's something that always fascinates me about like the Chinese economy. Like they're short like hundreds of thousands of just engineers in general. Like they can't import. Like, we're lucky in the United States. Our biggest, part of our biggest asset is immigration, is that we import this talent. So we can, like, sustain these type of operations. But even, like, other large global economies, I mean, they hemorrhage. It's funny. It's like once you start developing, you start losing all your smart people because they have enough money to leave.
Right. Ain't that the truth? All right, what other questions? You got any serious ones?
So I did have one that I kind of liked. Hey, Eric, I'm curious about the connection between wage inflation and market trends. How can us traders use this kind of data to make actionable moves? And I think this is kind of, Kyle, you did a great job last show dealing with me being too excited about labor and trying to keep the rubber meets the road. So I don't know if I think this person's, trying to poke that a little bit more. I talked more globally about like these geospatial modeling and stuff like that. But it was funny after we'd got off the call, I was sitting, I was getting ready to go to bed and something kind of hit me. And I was like, do you know what? I kind of barely talked about unemployment rates. Like we talked about minimum wage. We talked about like contextualizing how much people
talked about jobs reports too. One episode.
Yep. And when it hit me, I go, I never even broke out that there's interdisciplinary unemployment rates. You can literally look up unemployment rates of certain age groups and work backwards from there. And that's actually like, there's a lot of, people at large portfolios who look at this stuff. They don't view unemployment and inflation as separate entities. They actually view them as kind of one relationship. And there's something, it's called the Phillips curve, that talks about like, inflation and unemployment being in this kind of dance.
Is that just because the more people employed, the more money is in circulation?
Yeah. So, dude, right on. So, like, this is what makes it really interesting, is that you can have, like, a ton of people employed, and they're spending more, and it drives up inflation, costs go up, cost of business goes up, and then that makes labor more expensive, and then because labor's more expensive, you have to lay people off, and as, prices come back down, that means the amount of money you have to physically pay out for a productive worker, you get more production than that money you paid in, and suddenly unemployment goes back down because more people get, and you have this like ebb and flow. Right. That's why a lot of central banks really focus on inflation. Like the German central bank literally says their one goal is to maintain inflation. That's their, the Weimar Republic did a pretty bad job stopping World War II because of inflation. but I don't like to think everything's an economic output, but like everything's an economic output.
Right.
So that's one of the things like I completely glossed over last time. And I kind of like the question is your job report always needs to be contextualized against inflation. Mm-hmm. 100 out of 100 times. If you see, inflation coming down and you see the job report going up, that's an actionable trading item, especially if you see deflationary trends or stabilization trends like we're seeing right now. And you have a company you've been observing, they've been watching, wait to pounce on, and it has, and you're in an earnings cycle report, because guess what? You're going to have 3 job reports for every 1 earnings cycle you get. You can have a trend of how that company is dealing with personnel management. And at the end of the day, companies are people. There's very few companies that are, so capitalized that labor inputs don't matter. And there are some, don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. I would argue like, NVIDIA is probably one of them, where it's like you just have such advanced equipment, but even then you need to have such advanced technicians to use it.
And someone to repair it.
And somebody to repair it. We can say that again, Kyle. So I think contextualizing job reports against inflation, kind of looking at that trend. So while you're getting 3 job reports and 3 inflation trends per every earnings cycle, use that as part of your portfolio. If you see, inflation climbing, you see employment weakening, do you really want to take a long position or, an aggressive forward position in a company that's labor intensive, like retail? Maybe you think you kind of want to hedge off Walmart or Target or one of those companies prior to like the Christmas season. Mm-hmm. But if you're seeing higher inflation trends and weakening job reports before that, there's a good chance that's going to weaken their ability to make market expectations. And then when you're dealing with your January call, you could be on the bad side of that. Even if you only have a 90 to 120 day exposure period on it, you could really hurt yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's where labor can come in there and kind of help, help explain or predict a scenario.
So contextualizing jobs versus inflation. So if jobs numbers are going up, if we're filling more vacancies, then we should expect inflation to increase.
We should, because people should. I mean, if you have real wage increase,
is there a lag behind those types of like how much of a lag are you talking about?
Yeah. So we usually do see a lag. A little controversial how much lag period that is. So a lot of times when people build out these models, they'll assign their own lag period to it, and then observe it. Personally, I've seen 2-quarter lag periods. I've seen 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, all the way up to 8. You really won't see more than 8.
Anything more than 8, how do you still correlate it? And then at that point,
right, people are like, I have really robust results. I'm like, yeah, for 2 years ago, thanks. It's like, oh, did you bet on the Pats to win the 2004 Super Bowl? It's like, yeah, well, it's 2022. That doesn't 2024. It doesn't help matter anymore. That happened. Yeah, right. I do love like ultra long lag periods in some models that are used for market predictions. I'm like, what are you doing, man? Oh, your model's perfectly correlative to expectations. Yeah, because it's 2 year old data. Thanks.
I love that chart from the Pastafarians that shows that the global warming is directly correlated to the decrease in the number of pirates in the world. Correlation does not equal causation.
Oh, I know, right.
Let me give you my question I got here. This one, it says, Dear Eric, can you clarify your stance on minimum wage, BRICS, and the French system of government? And this one's from Mr. Hanks.
This is everything I have controversially believe in my life. I mean, generally speaking, my I think I've been pretty public on this on some of my writings. When it comes to minimum wage, I view minimum wage should be a protective.
You didn't really have to answer this.
Protective. If I pay you, can we do a show that's just how effed up France is when it comes their actual policies? I feel like France just like two countries that just get away with doing absolutely effed up things, and everybody's like, we should be more like them. Is France and Norway are two freaking countries. I'm just like, does anybody actually look at what those two? France basically like it like uses like currency manipulation to keep like African countries poor so they get like cheap uranium.
Yeah, I think we're really, yeah.
But like Norway, 37% of Norway's like I think it's like 37% of their tax revenue comes from like oil extraction, hydrocarbon extraction. So it's like so Norway's a petro state. It's a 5.5 million person petro state. And they just like gather all these hydrocarbons off like the North Sea and stuff, and they export them around the world. They just pollute the shit out of the world. But like, if we took global warming serious, like Norway would start getting poor real quick. So they have a pretty good sovereign wealth fund. But, like, people are like, why can't we be more like Norway? It's like, yeah, because we don't have like massive oil reserves per capita. They got a million people less than Massachusetts, and they got oil reserves that the Qatar with coats. Like, and so they have that, okay, and then, so the number one industry is hydrocarbon. Number two, I'm talking to somebody recently about this. I was talking to a policymaker recently about this, and I was like, the number one thing is hydrocarbon, so pollute the world. The number two industry is industrial fishing. It's horrible. 50% of all waste in the ocean is fishing. And then, I don't know if you've been following the UN on this, but they, so the UN had 2 years starting 2021 to come up with, international mining for sea nodules, for like the rare earth metals that are on the floor, on the sea floor, magnates and nickel and all that stuff. So they had 2 years to come up with that. Well, that expired in July of 2023. So now people could just mine. So like Nauru, out in like the Oceania, out in the Pacific, they're like working with contracts to do that. But Norway is now too. So I'm like, okay, great. So your three things are hydrocarbon extraction in the ocean, industrial marine fishing,
right,
and now deep sea mining. Those are the three things. Like, your economy is very dirty. But but we have good social programs. I'm like,
wait, isn't Norway the one where like your speeding tickets are based on your gross income? So
I could see. I know Switzerland does that.
Was it Switzerland? It's one of those Nordic countries too. I thought had that.
Yeah, Sweden. Probably Sweden too. Yeah, like I don't know, man.
10% of your gross annual income is your speeding ticket fine. Oh, fuck you!
Horrible. I was looking at people like, we need to be more like Norway. I was like, no. Hey, good for Norway, but like, no.
They're too small. They're small enough to get away with things like that.
Yeah, they're the guitar, like they're just guitar,
right?
But like more freedom of the press, but like I don't even know how Norwegian press works. Yeah, more fjords. They're like, nah, I mean, it's just funny. It's like you look more into these countries, you're like, like never ask a European eating an apple where that apple came from.
Oh god.
Because you're like, you ever see some blue tents in Portugal? It's like, ask those workers how their working conditions are. Not good.
The older I get, the more I feel like the U.S. is like the capital from the Hunger Games.
Mm. Oh, I think it's because we're number one that people just like, nobody looks at their own country. I was talking to I have a really good friend who's Austrian. He's a wicked nice guy. He was telling me something about it. He's like, oh, like there's so many poor people in America. And I was like, he's an economist. So right. Like, he's a macro guy. And I said to him, I go, what do you mean? He's like, well, you have a very, your country's poor. And I was like, what? I was like, no, like, I was like, dude, stop it. And he's like, what? I was like, dude, I'm not, you're not at the ECB. Like, shut up, man. I go, Spain, which is one of your wealthier countries, the median household income is 60% of Mississippi's median household income, which is our poorest state. Like,
yep.
Like we have money. Like, our poor, like, poor people in the United States have far higher values than poor people anywhere else. Like most European nations, their median income would be below the federal poverty line in the United States. So I say to my buddy, I go, you know, the poverty rate in Austria is 15% higher than the U.S. poverty rate. He goes, dead serious. He goes, no, they're not. I don't. So I'm on a call with him. So I'm just like, dude, I screen share and I show it to him. He goes, but why? But there's so many more poor people in the United States. And I'm like, dude, because you have a country of 8 million people. You have a country the size of New York City. Like that's why. I mean, yeah, I agree with you. They're physically less poor.
Do you lose your credentials if you're as an economist well, can't understand population or percentages?
Yeah. So like his thing is that he's big on like he analyzes like large white papers. So like I don't know if like he. And hey, listen, no matter how educated you are, you can be an idiot. it's like, true. You just hear something you want to hear.
Yeah, yeah.
So then I'm like, dude, your unemployment rate is 40% higher than the U.S. I'm like, what are you? He's like, well, he starts kind of like trying to bumble through stuff. I was like, you're a good economist, man. Like, you are. Like, you know this. And he's like, well, yeah, but like, it's different. Like, it's not fair. The U.S. has more resources. I'm like, but that doesn't change what the actual outcome is. I was like, dude, you see the connection here? That doesn't change the outcome. Like, oh, we are wealthier. We are this. I mean, the U.S. is now the world's largest oil producer, and that oil is only 8% of our GDP. And it's like, yeah, but that doesn't mean that's not a factual statement. That's the thing about economics. It's a painful field because it's just like, oh, it's a fact. That sucks, but it's what we're looking at.
Right.
That was very strange.
All right, do we have any more questions, or should we just dive in?
Let's dive in. I mean, if we have time to kill at the end, I have some goofy questions that got sent to me that are just it's just funny. All
right, we'll save that for the B-roll. All right, well, what are we talking about today, then?
Yeah, so we're actually going to probably my favorite topic besides labor, but probably the most useful one. that falls in my favorites, which is global economic trends and market responses. And I kind of, you know, Kyle, to be honest, I think this is something that I've often enjoyed about your podcast, or pretty much any media that I follow you on, is you do this better than I do, which is this whole, like, it's not just the news, it's what the news causes. Like, you know, how does the market move after something? And I know you and I have had great conversations on this.
Right.
So, like, about the plan to discuss today, I know we had some of our pre-docs that, you know, that we share, is that I'm one of those people, and, you know, being a public side guy, how do these public policy setting, how does that affect, you know, investable actions, both on the day side, mm-hmm. you know, on that short-term period, but I really think that these economic trends globally are something that function more like train tracks for day traders. Like, how you move from cart to cart is kind of the day side of it, but the end destination of that train as you're on it, I really think that's where these global economic trends and market responses, I think that's what it is. Because once the market makes a move to respond to something, it's in that direction. The market very rarely ever suddenly does a U-turn.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that type of economic momentum drags I'm a big believer that like finance and economics are, you know, partners together. I don't think one dominates the other. But I think sometimes when you have these major, especially on the global side, economic trends, the financial markets get dragged with it. And whether your strategy considers those trend changes or not, it's going to pull your portfolio with it. You may not see it on the day-to-day, but you'd probably see it over the course of a market cycle, so say, you know, 12 quarters. And that's what I really want to talk about today, because I think economics is particularly skilled at giving, you know, giving that financial information out to traders. And I think sometimes the short-term traders, they're, you know, they have to absorb so much data for so much quick decision-making that they don't realize where they're walking on the train and how these this type of information can help them even more down the road, down the tracks, if I'm sick with the analogy. So that's kind of what I'm hoping to discuss today, Kyle.
Yeah, I mean, I've not paid too much attention to other countries' like policy decisions or anything like that. I mean, obviously, like major headlines, like war breaking out in Ukraine is going to have a reaction to the markets. And
yeah.
And then there's things that happen from that, like Ukraine being one of the largest grain producers or fertilizer producers, causing wheat to go crazy. Like there's events that happen from like the geopolitical aspect of things that can have major impacts on the markets that are actionable. But I've not had too much experience with that, so I'm excited for this.
Yeah, I mean, Kyle, you hit the big one, which is like when you have, you know, conflict. I mean, especially when you shutter countries off from the rest of the world, like what happened in Russia and Iran and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it, that can, like Russia, for, I'll give you Russia for example. Like, you know, the U.S. does not, never really imported a lot of Russian fuel.
No.
Never did. It was always 1% or less of our total fuel imports. And to be honest with you, a lot of times it wasn't even half of that.
It makes sense. I mean, you don't really want to be relying on the peoples that you don't get along with that well.
Yeah, you should have told Germany that. We can shit on Germany. That's fine, man.
All right.
But Germany. One of the, like, right now, you know, Russia, you know, there's no import-export going on with the U.S. and Russia for you know, the vast majority because of all the sanctions for the vast majority of assets. But you can have these transitory effects. So if you're just in the news saying, oh, dude, we don't import oil from Russia, what does it matter? Well, Ukrainian attacks on Russian facilities have reduced their refinery capacity by 14%, which is an insane amount of capacity. Russia also put a 6-month ban on gasoline exports out of the country, on top of, you know, what could be 6 to 12 month shutdowns of refinery facilities because they're running out of Western parts, and more importantly, they actually don't have the in-house expertise to know how to repair these facilities.
Yeah.
And but people say, well, what does that mean for me in the U.S.? And I'm like, well, first off, oil is still it's still one of the biggest guiders of cross-market correlation, like across all industry clusters, no matter what you're investing in, oil has some play in that. India buys a ton of fuel from Russia, and it was buying it at a deep, deep, deep discount. And, you know, China purchases a lot of fuel from Russia. Well, I just named 1 in 4 people in the United States, in the world, like, are relying on this.
Right. Well, here's the other thing. Like, whenever you're talking with your spouse about money and, like, say, you know, you've got an extra $200 that you want to spend for something for her, but she wants to spend it on the kids or something like that. She'd be like, well, I want to take that money to use over here, but I don't want you to have to pay for that. So I'll use my cash to pay for the kids' money. And then not that way you don't have to do it. But no, it's all the same pile. We all are taking from the same piece. If 14% of Russia's oil output has been compromised or lost, that's a smaller slice of the pie for everybody. That shortfall is going to get made up from somewhere, and that's going to come from the supplies that are coming to us.
Perfect. That's exactly what it is. I mean, that's what
I don't know if that was a good analogy, but
no, that's the exact analogy. So it's fungibility, you know, the ability to reclassify things. And when, you know, it's funny, when the Ukrainian grain deal came out, I remember reading news stories, people were like, Ukraine, they're not actually sending the grain to poor countries. I'm like, no, but you're just increasing the supply. I'm like, right. Again, you know, it's an old joke I always say. Like, people hit a certain age and think they become economists. It's like, it's just adding more to the supply side of the market.
It's your 40-year degree.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You're just shifting that line to the right. Now, that type of trend has massive impacts. And we're actually seeing that. We're seeing this, like, weird thing in the oil market right now, where we should be seeing a little more suppression. If we look at this as like, say, a pretty large cyclical, you know, let's say we expand our data pool 12, 15 years, we're actually not seeing that softening historically we would see this time of year.
Is that because of the election coming up? Because normally, don't prices usually go up coming into the summer months?
Yes, they usually do. And like, when we say softening that effect, I mean like marginal softening. Like it's not doing its normal, you know, what you'd expect. And, you know, that has to do with a lot of this lack of production coming out of Russia. So if you're somebody, you know, day trading in Ohio, you may not want to think about that. You may just be looking at the numbers on the chart. But, you know, if you're investing in infrastructure, you're investing in pharmaceuticals, you're investing in retail, like those are all petroleum-based industries. Mm-hmm. And there's less petroleum now. And what's very funny is that the further you go along in the value-added process, taking raw crude oil and getting to diesel is a less intensive process than taking, you know, petroleum products and getting to their use in pharmaceutical. Mm-hmm. But the more value you add in that process, that's more GDP, but that's also more values companies can add. So it's kind of like a pyramid where you, as you reduce the foundation of it, you see more change at the top on that narrow part, becomes more marginal. So these effects we're seeing over in Russia with the lack of petroleum products, there will be a lag effect. Mm-hmm. But you could actually see a hit market. You could see larger marginal effects down the road in, say, pharmaceuticals. That's going to work into your investment strategy. Like that's something as a day trader you need to always have in your background. Like there's a ticking time clock for how much capacity some of these places may have. They're not that they're going to run out of product, but that the price points of these products in their financial models that they had a year ago is going to be incorrect because they didn't see this coming. Maybe they did. I mean, maybe you could look at, I mean, certainly on some rating calls, sitting on some ratings calls, I've heard companies discuss that they've had this built in, but I've also heard other companies ignore it. And that, I find that kind of telling when they ignore it. Does that mean somebody's like, we didn't factor that in?
It'll sort itself out.
Exactly. I think the biggest one right now to look at is, I'm actually gonna steal a line from my cousin who was on Bloomberg a few days ago, so hopefully he won't copyright me on this because it was a damn good point. And he basically said like we have checkered monetary policy across the world right now, which is rare. Like we have, if you look at percent of global economy, it's all strange right now. So like the U.S. is in this like holding pattern. Their post rate hike. China's right cutting right now. But this like Swiss, they haven't really had inflation, so they've just been like they're not in post hike or post. They're just sitting there.
Still haven't figured that out.
Yeah, that's very strange. They just like that happens when you're like an ultra like the place in the country that experienced the least amount of inflation was New England, because it's already an expensive area. So like if you're in an expensive area, it takes longer to feel any price hikes. It should be really funny if like. 5 years from now, the Swiss get hit with inflation because it just took that long to climb up the ladder. I like the Swiss. That's like a shot at them, just saying like a statistic. And I think that's something important for day traders to remember is that, you know, when you have these mixed policies all across the world for how central banks are dealing with their, you know, with their systems. I mean, you probably saw, you know, I think when you were out here, Kyle, we were discussing what happened with Japan. Mm-hmm. With the yen, which is just like they basically had to go grab a bunch of foreign currency off the market because the yen just weakened to an all-time low. And that's another policy that like that's not really a rate decrease or increase, but it kind of is because they just kind of sucked up a bunch of foreign currency to bolster their reserves. Like that's a move.
What is the impact on that? That just means there's less in circulation, right? What is that?
Yeah, so basically it means there's less in circulation, but it also means like if you need to buy yens out of the market, that means you're pushing your foreign currency reserves out, which means you're effectively destabilizing, in a sense, the currency, because now the currency is backed by itself, as opposed to having like the reason the Swiss are so resilient to inflation is that the Swiss central bank is like has real estate, has company holdings, U.S. dollars. British pound, euros, like
diversified.
They have such, dude, right? Like, I mean, I know it sounds comical, but it's almost like the Swiss central bank doesn't have Swiss francs.
Right, that's like kind of what it sounds like.
Yeah, and that can be really good, especially for a really intensified economy that's constantly dealing with import and export, specifically on the import side. And Japan is a very heavy importation country. It does great exports, don't get me wrong. Like, they're a healthy trade economy.
You just don't have a lot of raw materials, like scrap iron, right? Things like that, yeah.
Yeah, like they're not finding any copper mines in Japan. Like,
no, they find a lot of them in China.
Yeah, right. So you can weaken your ability to trade outwards as you like devaluing your currency helps with exports. Mm-hmm. That's great for exports.
Yep.
But if you really rely on imports and your currency starts devaluing, you can end up what happens in Venezuela. Like Japan's not going to go that way. There's an old joke in economics. There's four economies. There's developed economies, developing economies, Brazil and Japan.
What about Turkey?
Yeah, Turkey's interesting. I know. Talk about like one of those economies. It's just like, it's weird to see, you know, and this is another example of like following these global economic trends where Turkey's really emerging as a power broker in that area of the world. And they control the Bosphorus Straits. So they control one of the largest, you know, grain transfers mm-hmm. in the world. Like it's just this little 18, I think it's like 18 miles from entrance to exit. It's like 20% of the world. I don't know if it's 20%. I've heard estimates that's like 20% of the world's wheat trade goes through there. I'm like, jeez, that's crazy.
Wow. Good for Turkey.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right, yeah. So, and they have a growing defense industry.
Longtime fans of the show should be familiar with the lender formerly known as Sue Pullen, and I'm pleased to announce that she's back, fresh off a rebrand and ready to help as Sue Mackey. Sue is a certified mortgage advisor at Fairway Independent Mortgage, an equal housing lender who focuses on finding the right product for you and your needs. She has over 20 years of experience helping thousands of homeowners. Whether it's purchasing, refinancing, or even a reverse mortgage, Sue will help. Sue's licensed in 36 states now, so reach out and let Sue Mackey it happen for you. The best way to reach her is just give her a call at 520-977-7904 or in an email, spullen@fairwaymc.com. Fairway Independent Mortgage has an MLS number of 2289. Sue Mackey has an MLS number of 206048. That email again, spullen@fairwaymc.com. And that phone number is 520-977-7904. Shoot Sue an email and let her know she needs to update that address.
Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
So what are some of the foreign like headlines or reports or trends or things that we should be paying attention to then?
Yeah, I think if we start here, if we start, you know, the Western Hemisphere, I think Argentina is a big one with Milei. So Argentina, for the first time in, I think, like 12 years, could be more or less, posted a surplus. And right now they're going through this really awkward phase where they're seeing, Argentina's historically had like crazy inflation. Milei comes in, libertarian guy, wants to.
Are they the ones that just like printed a 10,000 whatever unit currency bill?
Oh, did they?
I don't know if that was them. Somebody did. I just saw a headline. I can't remember who it was.
You know, that I could see Argentina doing that.
That's kind of what I thought too.
So yeah, they're trying to dollarize their economy, right? And I don't know if they are going to dollarize, but when Milei took over, I mean, they had negative, their central bank had negative positions, which is wild.
What?
Yeah, so they literally had more foreign currency reserves out the door than they had in actual holdings. So they were going to have to go buy foreign currency. But, you know, they slashed spending and they slashed all these programs and they end up with a surplus. But what's crazy is that, you know, you see the constantly deflating value of the, of Argentina's currency. And stabilized. It's stable. It's like since he's been in there, it's been almost just flat. So it's a store of value. And once that happens, I mean, you're talking about stabilizing one of the most populous countries in South America with a ton of resources and like all these things. I'm like, that's good for their, that's good for the South American economy. Like,
it was Argentina. Yeah. The 10,000 peso banknote.
Does it look nice?
I mean, I sent you the link. It looks like somebody from here on the bill, actually. Oh, geez, they've had annual inflation nearing 290%. And they're going to do a 20,000 pound or 20,000 peso note later this year. Did you want to take back any of those nice things you said about them stabilizing their currencies?
No, I mean, this is kind of the process they have to go through. I mean, like, this is what's going to happen. I mean, they got to do the fact, like, inflation's more of a product. Well, inflation's a product for a lot of things. Like, just printing bills with higher denominations doesn't necessarily, like, if you suddenly say every $1 bill in the United States, yeah, Zimbabwe, that's more. If you suddenly say every single dollar in the United States adds a zero to the end of it, India did the opposite of this with the lock system, right? That doesn't mean in real terms prices went up.
Right.
Like, that's inflation. Inflation has to be this erosion of real value. So even if you add, you know, 20,000, 200,000, whatever you, I mean, right behind me, I mean, I have bolivares from Venezuela, which is just cartoony. I have Zimbabwe money. It's just really useless. I have the kwacha, which is like what they really effed up. That was like the first one they effed up in the early 2000s. What we're seeing right now is that like real value isn't changing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that's rare for Argentina. Like a lot of prices are sticky, which doesn't happen in inflation when you're in these heavy inflationary periods. And what you need your currency to do, whether the currency says 20,000 on it or it says one on it, is it needs to be a store of wealth.
Right.
And we're slowly seeing that. And a product of that is you have federal, or I should say national balance sheets that are in the surplus. And they went from, you know, decade, over a decade of every month running a deficit, which is like, okay, so you have to print money. That's called seniorage. That's also the reason you don't see that crazy inflation in the United States, is that we don't practice seniorage. Mm-hmm. So like, we have these debt arguments because we have to borrow money to keep our balance sheet operational because we won't print money. Where a lot of South American nations just print money, and they have to print money because they have negative balance sheets, right? So you get 50% inflation, right? Argentina hasn't had to do that since Milei's gotten in office. And yeah, there's problems like Rosario. I don't know if you follow Argentina, like Rosario's having a, you know, like a narco issue right now that Argentina's really never had.
In South America, really?
Yeah, right. So, but it's weird to see, it is weird to see like the aftermath of like a libertarian getting elected. Like when you're in a part of the world, you see this global trend of like, for Argentina, historically has been this like, you know, more nationalistic or nationalization trended nation going the opposite direction. And you start to see their national accounts go positive. Like that's an investment. Like you can invest in that economy now.
Right.
And
okay.
One of the interesting things about Argentina is that it has some of the largest deposits of silicate in the world. And the next generation of batteries, solid state batteries, which there are solid state batteries, but solid state batteries, and Elon Musk actually bought a bunch of silicate mining rights in Nevada and Mexico about this. Hmm. Silicate is a much more ecologically friendly, and it doesn't have the horrible, horrible, you know.
So you're getting away from lithium finally?
Yeah, lithium and cobalt. And they can, so it's like, oh, what does it matter that Argentina now has like this? It's like, well, that's where a lot of the silicate is, and we can use that to power electric cars.
That's good for Argentina.
Yeah, and so you go, wait, so maybe I should give a shit about Argentina. I think the scariest thing right now in the world when it comes to, you know, political moves that go against economic rationale is what's happening in China right now. And I know that's an exhausting thing. Everybody talks about China. Like, I'm not going to get on this, the broad stroke stuff. But right now, Xi Jinping had like this big, he's going through this big reform, and he ordered a lot of Chinese firms to buy stocks and, you know, all that stuff, which is, dude, that happens all the time. I'm like, there's way better economists and finance experts who can talk about that.
Where's Jack Ma?
Honestly. But what I would think, I would talk to, some nuance that has gotten lost, I think, in the discussion that I found quite interesting. And I get it. The sexy headline is China's cutting rates, which is like, people are like, what are you doing, man? But there's a more insidious aspect to this. And that is, if you look at household expenditures and disposable income in China, it's falling. And okay, you know, that's not a bad thing. That's not a good thing. But the gap between what China's manufacturing and what their people can afford is reaching this new gap that's been getting bigger and bigger and bigger. It's kind of hit a crisis point. If you have an economy where people can afford microwaves, but you're building windmill terminals or windmill generators and stuff like that, you are basically using the labor you have in your economy to subsidize exports because you're not allowing your labor to be fully priced. If your labor is fully priced, the people have more disposable income, they can afford more things and generate a self-sustaining internal market. They're going further away from that. They're not usually developing economies close that gap. They're not.
Interesting.
Which is scary.
I know China has always been on my radar. Just they're the ones that you see popping up, like the big property giants, like missing their payments. What was the one, like a bunch of people like put down payments for houses that hadn't even been built yet, and they're defaulting on it. How can you default on a house that you haven't even received yet?
Oh, this story is the people buying houses in China and there's gold in them just to offset the price they pay. I mean, there's cities.
What?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was like a huge issue. I think last year. I don't know how much like news that made, but I remember reading more than a few articles on it. And like they would have houses and say the house is $250,000. It'd be like $70,000 in gold inside to prop up like
the value of the house. is it all in a gold plated toilet or is
no, but right and
or just bars laying on
like bars. It's not like I'm like, oh my gosh. But one of the reasons, so China dropped under a billion people in population, and people were like, I remember talking to a couple guys on this, some demo guys I know who are fucking absolutely brilliant, like demographic analysts and economists and statisticians are some of the smartest people you ever meet in your life. And I said to them, I'm an idiot on this. I go, so I like talking to experts. Kyle, you know this. I'm lazy. I say this to you all the time. Yeah. Because I love talking to you.
Me too.
Is I'm lazy and I like talking to you. You're an expert and it makes me feel better.
That's kind, generous use of the term expert.
Oh, come on. And they said something funny to me. They go, Eric, it's pretty straightforward. They built all this new property. These demographic estimates are based on units. And these cities that are supposed to have millions of people in them have like 250,000. And so when that correction came in, you know, they dropped hundreds of millions of people. And I go there and I'm like, you can't beat demographics. It's very hard. The only country on earth that has seemed to beat demographics has been the US because we just have so much immigration that drives our economy. That you can't win against demographics. Like once that wave gets past you, there's nothing you can do about it. It happened in Japan and it's happening in China now, which is that like, hey, Japan got to 85% of our GDP.
Yeah, and then they just stopped for 30 years.
Yep, and is China doing that now? And then is that, so the answer is who's the next person? It's India. India has 1.4 billion people, a really interesting economy. They have an economy that's like intensified but never went through the manufacturing area. Like it was just strange. But they have the GDP of England, like 2.5 like trillion GDP. And it's like, that's a long way from, you know, 25, 30 trillion that the U.S. has. So, like, you can't fight those demographics. But demographics are, you know, very slow moving. It's a frog boiling scenario. And that's why I always say to people, when I talk to traders, especially day traders, you know, you have these portfolios and you may be making actionable moves in the short term. But are you planning on stopping in a year? 2 years?
Right.
3 years? Well, congratulations. You may be a day trader, but you're in it for the long haul. Unless you're planning on stopping.
Right.
Kyle, have you ever met a day trader who plans on stopping?
No. Well, here's the other thing, too. Well, every day trader I've talked to who's been successful ends up transitioning at some point or is in the process of transitioning to more swing long-term type plays. Like you build up a big enough nest egg and then you start living off of the easy investments.
Yeah. Bonds become pretty popular after that.
I bet.
it's like the political saying, every revolutionary is a conservative the day after the revolution.
All right.
No, but it's, but that, you know, I talk to people about that. And what I find very, when I started on this, like when I started, you know, doing more my podcasts and things like that, I was always very interested because I've told you this, Kyle, I'm the boringest investor in the world. I'm a boring guy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a like bonds and stuff like that. I know that stuff fairly well, but I would find like a lot of day traders loved hearing the economic side of stuff. And I think it's because every day trader as much as I think it's not so much that people become day traders and then they become interested in this stuff. I think they're just interested in it.
Yeah.
And they find a way to make decisions on it. So at the core of it, I do think a lot of day traders are economists. They just don't know it. They just don't realize it.
Well, you're always looking for the answer of why. What happened? Why did that happen? What was the catalyst? And then it just naturally, if you're a curious person, which I think you have to be in order to be a trader, you're going to want to know, why did the market sell off 3% today? Well, let's go look at the headlines. I'm sure there's something in there that might explain it.
No, exactly. It's it's funny. I noticed a similar trend. I was talking to a gentleman I work with, and we were talking about school and stuff like that. I made a comment that, like, you know, political science is it's always an interesting degree. I mean, people have a lot of opinion on it. And I said, you know, in my classes, I can see what people's majors are. And when my microecon class, I'm always surprised, like, how well the political science kids do. Because, like, poli-sci usually doesn't give you, like, the analytical background or the mathematic background to really make my class easy. Anybody can pass my class, dude. It's really good. Just try, and don't cheat. Like, you're fine.
Is political science a serious degree? I always thought that was, like, business communications.
Dude, right? So I think that's kind of the attitude a lot of people have. And so this gentleman was talking to me, and he was kind of surprised when I made the comment to him that, like, there's a lot of poli-sci kids who do good in my class. Most universities, microecon at the 201 level, mm-hmm. is a 50% D withdraw or fail. 50% attritional class.
Wow.
It's usually it's like the finance kids do excellent, the econ majors do really good, and then math kids do really good. Because at the end of the day, if you can calculate an elasticity of demand and you know how a chart works, you've already done 75% of the work.
Right.
I mean, if you can draw it on a chart, you can answer any question. But poli-sci kids don't come in with that type of background. And they do, you know, I get a lot of those kids who get B's in that. Hmm. And talking to this gentleman who in poli-sci background, he said to me, he's like, wow, he's like, kind of, why about that? And I said to him, because he's always, him and I talk about economics all the time. And I go, because they're interested. They have to work harder. Mm-hmm. I go, the freaking engineer, the electrical engineers that take my class as an elective, I don't even see them.
Yep, right.
they get a 95 because they're like, they write very technical,
mm-hmm.
and they can do calculus. So me being like, what's the marginal value of this thing? They're like, they don't even do the chart.
No, they'd be sleeping.
No, they do calc. They're like, for sure, there it is. but the poli-sci kid, he's the kid writing, you know, a 6-paragraph post, and I can read him and see him thinking out the problem.
Mm-hmm.
He may not come in, he or she may not come in with that inherent advantage, but they like economics for exactly what you just said, because it explains stuff. And to me, I see traders as the quantitative version of that.
Yeah.
Where they're like, how do I make this work for me? Oh, wait a minute. I'm also curious why this happens.
Right.
That's why I think these macroeconomic trends are so important, because, like, I'll give you another example right now. I don't know if people follow what's going on in South Korea, but South Korea is getting kind of a little messy,
mm-hmm.
for two reasons. One, they have very centralized companies. You know, these companies are like Samsung and Kia and stuff like that. I'm sorry, Hyundai.
Daewoo.
Who make everything from bubble gum to tanks.
Like, right.
He was talking about the U.S. having conglomerates.
Actually, I read a really cool book that kind of explained why that happens. It's like part of like the developing nation. Like as you go from third world to developed nation, like you have these mega corporations that basically just buy up everything. And so you have a fucking company that's making handguns and bicycles.
Yeah.
It makes no sense, yeah, but it's like the natural progression.
Yeah, dude, and you're 100% right. That's what happened in Korea. In South Korea, they basically were like, oh shit, the economy sucks. South Korea was poorer than North Korea. And they were like, we're going to have this military government takes over. And they were like, all right, what's the fastest way we can develop? Hey, giant company, you want to make everything?
Right.
But right now, 40% of all South Koreans don't pay rent.
Really?
Yeah. And so they practice this system, which I'm not going to try and pronounce. I have a very dear friend whose wife is Korean, and if she hears me pronounce it this way, she will call and yell at me, rightfully so. So how
I'll just bleep. I can bleep it if you want to give it a shot.
It's like I can see the word in my head and I can't fucking say it. So how the system works is banking in South Korea. Banking is the most important financial institution that exists in the world by far.
Yeah.
And when South Korea started developing in the 70s and 80s, there was a lot of private landowners who wanted to basically need to finance future projects.
Mm-hmm.
So what they would do is you would show up on a 2-year lease. You get a house for 2 years and you'd give them, say, $100,000. That's $100,000. Let's say $100,000 up front for a year, for a two-year lease, and then you wouldn't pay anything for the 2 years, and then at the end they'd give you $100,000 back.
Wait, that's a sweet deal.
Yeah.
Oh, so they get the interest on it.
They get the interest because South Korea maintained these Wakanai interest rates. But this was considered a private transaction. So there was no taxation on it. There was no like overly laborious process. But they would take that, your landlord would take like $100,000 and buy like another property,
right,
and another property. And then you could just keep instantly replicating this. And for the South Korean, that's kind of a good deal, right? Like you start off in a small house, you give your landlord $10,000. You work for 2 years, you get your $10,000 back plus all your wages. You got $20,000 and you move to a nice house until you can eventually afford to buy a house. The system seems kind of nice, right?
Yeah, doesn't seem terrible.
Yeah. What if your property value goes down?
Yeah, that could be a problem.
Yeah. Now you have that chandelier effect where you have so many properties, you're so over leveraged that, you know, usually the deposit up front is like anywhere from 40 to 60, 70% of value. And so a market correction of 10% because of like those ratios, you know, would mean that if you're so expanded, you literally at, you know, 2 years when it's time to move out, your landlord may not have the money.
Right.
In South Korea, it's something like 8 people bought like 5,000 to 8,000 of the new units that were created, or new unit. Like they are responsible for the vast majority of all new unit purchases. And that can be very difficult because the government's incentivized not to correct that. But that's a cost. If you're choosing not to correct that, like, that can hurt the South Korean economy. So that macro trend in South Korean real estate can bleed over into Samsung. Samsung owns a bunch of these properties. So like you could be investing in Samsung right now, trying to make a play on it because you like their new smartphone. And because of some really interesting real estate macro trend, your investment in a smartphone gets completely derailed because Samsung has to bail out its own property. And you're like, why do I have real estate exposure? I'm buying cell phones.
How much real estate does Samsung own?
Like a shit ton. I think they might be the largest land owner in South Korea.
I'm making a note. I'm going to chart them this weekend. I want to take a closer look at that.
Yeah, and it's...
because that sounds shortable.
Yeah. Oh, it's like genuinely kind of scary right now. I mean, Japan right now has thousands of houses that are free because they can't... The earthquake standards decay so quickly, like the way the houses are designed, that the real estate's not worth anything. So you can't even give away a house.
Wow. Are they having like a huge housing surplus anyway over in Japan just because of the way their population demographic is aging?
Yeah, so
I think the U.S. is going to go through something similar when the baby boomers start to kick the bucket.
Yeah, yeah. So right now our replacement rate in the United States, so you need to be 2.1. If you basically stop growing if you fall below 2.1. Average births per woman. There's some weird math, but you can have this like adjusted version that accounts for immigration. So we're about 2.17 now. We're the only OECD nation that's growing right now. So we're the only like major developed economy that is seeing sustained population growth.
Is that without immigration?
No, that's with immigration.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, we're only 1.6 without immigration.
I was going to say immigration's been... as much as people shit on immigration or want to protect the borders, like how many great countries have become economic powerhouses because of their immigration policies?
Every single one of them.
Like the Netherlands, like you think the Dutch or Holland,
yeah, right,
had anything special going on for them other than that?
No, I mean, like it is strange. Like I, as a labor economist, it always confuses me because there's no economist who thinks immigration's bad. It's not even a debatable point. Like in the U.S. is incredibly pro-immigration if you compare us to the rest of the Western world. Like in the U.S., we debate illegal immigration versus legal immigration. That's our debate. Right. There's, I don't know, really anybody who walks around for economic reasons. There might be, you know, political and racial reasons that, you know, people would be like that. But there's no economic policymaker who's like, oh, weighing it out. Where in Europe, they argue anti-immigration versus immigration. They don't even, there's people who, and it's like, dude, you guys are old countries. Like, man, you got your old countries with very expensive welfare states. You need immigration. Like, you're the poster child of this. But it's funny. I remember I was having a conversation one time, and labor economics is kind of a difficult field because it's we can't test things because you'd have to test them on people, which is usually frowned upon, generally speaking. So we have like all these quasi-experimental models we get to do. Brain drain models and stuff like that. But one of them, there's a stupid argument that, immigration suppresses wages. I'm always like, that's a dumb argument. That doesn't make it. That's like saying, population growth suppress wages. No, it doesn't. Population growth increases wage. But there's something called like the Mariana Lift. And it's when like all these Cubans fled Cuba and went to Miami. And there's like 170,000 new people in Miami. Average wage went up because I always say this. They don't just bring their labor supply. They also bring their demand for goods and services.
Yes, they're.
I don't know. It is always strange because I find people. I feel like it's a good exposure to somebody's political leanings to hear their economic rationale on immigration.
I think the only argument I could hear somebody trying to make would be that they're sending their money they earn outside of the country.
Yeah, so I heard that argument before, and I had some guy, many times in my life I've been yelled at for just objective economic explanations. Like, very few times, I can actually, very, very seldomly, I've actually been yelled at for my opinion in economics. Like explaining what's just not Eric Mason's opinion on economics, which is like an objective reality.
Right.
Just yelled at. I won't say it was. I'm getting yelled at by this person. And I said to them, I go, I couldn't understand what they were getting at. They were like, getting angry at me. And they brought up that point. And I go, you mean remittance? And the guy's like, what? And I go, remittance. And he goes, what's remittance? I go, you hate immigration because you think they're sending money back to the country. Did you not? You have Google, man. Take out your phone. You never even bothered to, there's a name for that. It's called remittance. And he goes, yeah. He goes, they send back trillions of dollars. I was like, trillions? Okay. So there's no scale here. I go, we measure that, right? He was like, what do you mean? We measure that? How do you measure that? I'm like, I don't know, the same way we measure I think it's crazy that we measure unemployment. That's a way weirder stat to measure. but yeah, we measure remittance is something we measure, and it's so immaterial. And it's a good point on your side. That is an argument I've heard many times. And I saw the dude was in my office, and I have a big monitor. Have you seen my office? That giant curvy thing. and I was like, I turned it around. And I was like, I had the Federal Reserve Economic Database up, and I was like, what country? Mexico, remittance. And I'm like, remittance. And I was like, and then on the other side of the screen, I'd have the US GDP. And he was right. But it seemed like a big number. And it was funny.
Factor it over you got to add it up for all the years, the history of the states, and then you might have something meaningful.
It was funny because he was looking at the lines, and the lines look similar. And he's like, see, the lines are kind of similar. I was like, okay. And I adjusted them so they were both in trillions of dollars. And he was like, where's the other line? I'm like, you can't see it because it's overlapping the x-axis.
The zero.
Yeah. Then he told me that all economists should go to common sense school.
Oh, wow.
I was like, okay, you just leave my office, please? I have things to do.
Which congressman was this?
No. It's okay.
Kidding.
Dude, it was a strange conversation. I'm like, no, if you want to just be, so I told him, you just want to be angry at illegal immigrants. That's your prerogative, man. I go, don't use my field. Because, the more you stare into my field, the more wrong you're going to be.
God, what is it?
Weird.
Fake science they used to try to prove racial theories?
Phrenology.
Or whatever.
That was like when they would measure people's...
Measuring the cranium. Yeah.
Yeah. So funny story about that. A couple days ago, I was getting yelled at by some dude on Reddit. Because he said phrenology. Because I can't. I love being just an aggravating person. I'm on Reddit and this dude comments, he's like, well, phrenology is just this judging people on their looks. And I'm like, no, it's not. It's a pseudoscience about measuring people's cranium to see how intelligent they are. And so he goes, he writes, I linked to the Encyclopedia Britannica on it. So I made the mistake. I commented that before looking at his profile. Dude, this is the most negative dude, just exhaustingly negative guy. I respect that, the energy of that. So he responds, he goes, dude, I'm going to fucking read. Hold on. I got my phone right here. It was the funniest thing he wrote. I'm going to read you the exact thing he wrote because it was absolutely hilarious.
Fucking Reddit.
Dude, Reddit is so funny, man. Like, It's funny. A guy works for me. I saw he had written on his phone, and I was like, I don't want to know your tag or anything about that. That's the fun thing. Yeah. So he commented, this is one of my favorite things in the world. He comments, he goes, there's a correlation between cranial cubic density and IQ. It's only a dangerous science because it's dangerous to modern sensibilities. You chump. He gets downvoted. So here's my response. I go, yes, the old favorite, correlation versus causality. Also, what made up term is cranial cubic density. The cranium is the skull. You literally just said thick-skulled people are smart. What that means? I go, also, cubic density? Do you think we live in a 2D world? That's such a redundant phrase. I go, neuron density and neuroplasticity are the causal factors. I go, great move ignoring that your original claim that phrenology is just judging people on how they look being completely wrong to the point that you accepted my correction and started making some quasi-tough guy modern sensibilities argument. And I was very happy because this dude writes paragraphs. I could see his comments. His only response was, okay, liberal. And I go, liberal? I go, I'm an Austrian economist. I write the things you probably use like in your school that you don't understand. I go, I'm not a liberal. I just don't like faux intellectuals masquerading as tough guys for entering disprovable science. I go, there's enough stupidity in the world. Don't add to it.
I'm about to link your Reddit profile.
So no, it's horrible. But I was just like, dude, I hate you. Yeah, but phrenology. I was just like, dude, don't just like, but it's shit like that, man. People like, and I love when I interact with people like that who write like paragraphs and stuff. And I get like a one or two word response. But I'm like, fucking try to cubic cranial density? Like that's, why you, dude, just go outside, touch grass, man. Like, fucking, you don't need to shit, not thinking phrenology's real.
Of course you have a story on phrenology. The worst, this is completely off topic and it probably means we're getting to the end of the episode here, but. Future Kyle here with a quick warning. Things are about to go off the rails. So if you choose the end of the episode here, don't blame you. Otherwise, stick around.
I thought we
the worst one. The worst one I ever got involved with on the internet was I got in an argument with somebody about the moon. He was trying to explain that the full moon has a measurable effect on people, and it was obvious that was the fact because the gravity. I was like, you realize that just because you can't see the moon doesn't mean it's not there, right?
What?
Gravity doesn't change during the full moon cycle.
Did you point at tides?
I did.
The tides don't stop. Jesus. I don't know, man. I think there should be like, I don't know, man. I think we should. I think everybody's entitled to have an opinion, but I think we need to do a better job as society of just being like, no, you're wrong.
There's got to be a hot take score.
Yeah.
Like, oh, this person likes to, when he gets a few beers in him, he likes to claim that, you know, the Nazis had some good points.
Yeah, like that.
Maybe we don't want to listen to that guy as much.
Yeah, like that guy, let's reduce his ability to perpetuate things.
Right.
I have one of my favorite people I work with. He just loves, he does it purely for the sake of argument, which is be like, we didn't land on the moon.
Oh God, I hate those people.
And he says it. And I always tell him, like, dude, you're too smart, well respected to have that stupid of an opinion. And I know for a fact he doesn't believe it. He just likes to see people's responses because he's wicked, wicked smart. He's one of the smartest people I've ever met. And I think he likes just seeing how people argue stuff. So,
oh yeah, I do that sometimes. Take the counter argument just because it's fun to see if you can actually win.
Oh yeah, yeah. Like I do that a lot. Like I'll just take counter arguments on stuff just to piss people off. So
my wife hates it.
Oh, it's a blast though. So he says this to me, and he knows how I am. He knows how easy I am to go on this rant. So I look at him down the face. I go, do you know? I go, where does color come from? He was like, what? Because he was talking about like how the Hubble telescope. We see pictures, but they're not really pictures. They're, they're not in color. I was like, yeah, no shit. It's measuring in the visible light spectrum.
Right. It's a lot of X-rays and ultraviolet. And...
yeah. So I said to him one time, I go, what is color? And he's like, what? And I go, no, if we're going to play this game, I go, I like to play this game. I'm an idiot. I go, how do you get color? Like, how do you see a color? And he goes, I don't know what you mean. I go, no, see, you do this. Like, you will ask people, how do you get to the moon? And you want them to explain it. And I can say to explain to you how, like, oh, Saturn V rocket, here's, you know, exit velocity, you need to reach, you know, a little over 17,000 miles an hour, you have this angular shot, the reason you do it down in Florida is because you have the equator, you gain 1,000 kilometers per hour in speed and all this stuff. I can walk through that. Oh, the Van Allen belt, no, you're going through it so fast, it doesn't really matter. I can do all that.
Oberth effect?
Yeah. And like, so I say to the guy, I go, okay, so let's play the game. I go, can you explain colors to me? And he was just like, oh, I hate you, Eric. He's like, no, actually, I was like, well, you get, you know, photons hit atoms at the valence electrons get really excited. They jump up a level very quickly. They fall back down. That releases a photon. That photon has a certain wavelength. That wavelength hit your eyes. You have these cones in your eyes. And I go, that's what converts your, you know, the neurological signals to color, to see color. And I go,
which one is that, the photoelectric effect?
Yeah, so photoelectric effect's part of it. Like, so I sit down, I'm like, okay, so I was like, flip it around, man. I was like, so you can't explain to me what a color is, so how are you to say which one's a color, which one's not? Like, how do you not know it can't see in color? And then he's like, well, how do they know that? And I was explaining like spectrometry to him. And I go, I'm just being an asshole. I'm like, he's like, well, how do you know they're not going to find new atoms? And I go, okay, what comes after two? He's like, three. It's three, four, five. Just keep going.
Right. Yeah.
Oh. And I'm like,
we found a bunch more, but they're all unstable.
Super unstable.
Ridiculously fast.
Yeah. And so we always have a wicked fun discussion on it. And he's literally one of my favorite people to talk to because he's like the opposite of the kind of what we were talking about earlier, where he just enjoys that like tit for tat on it. So
yeah,
what we didn't have any, we had a meeting one day and he's in my office. Afterwards, we talked for like an hour about this because I'm like, no, I've been wanting to do this for years and go all the way through it. And my family used to own a gas station. My parents recently retired and sold it. And he was a customer. So he comes in afterwards and says to my dad, he's like, I just had like an hour long conversation with your son on him just aggressively explaining the moon landing to me. He goes, and I think he won. And my poor dad is like, yeah. Yeah, that sounds like Eric. He goes, when he was a little kid, he used to make us buy him like giant books on like black holes and stuff like that. He goes, I think Eric enjoyed, he goes, I think Eric enjoyed it more that you didn't think the moon landing happened because you got to explain it. And the guy was just like, yeah, you know me, I can't let stuff go. He's just like,
yeah.
Yeah, he just really, he had an answer for everything. He had like an overly technical explanation. I said, it's not for you. It's for the guy who actually believes you didn't go to the moon.
See, I talked to a guy like that, one of my dad's friends, who legit did not believe in the moon landing. And I did the same thing. Every freaking point he had, I had the counterpoint. I even pointed to his wife, who was wearing a fucking NASA shirt. She didn't know this. She about lost her fucking mind while I was trying to make this argument at them.
Yeah, it's like 25% of people don't believe we went to the moon. I'm like,
my daughter was almost one of those. My daughter came home one day and said she didn't believe in space.
Wait.
I was like, no. We've put the telescope up in the backyard. You've looked at Jupiter. You cannot tell me you don't believe in space.
But like, in what?
It was a 16-year-old kid just basically saying.
Oh, okay. That's normal.
Just something fun. Yeah. Yeah. But I squashed that one pretty quick.
Yeah, like, I mean,
I'm not having this in my house.
Like, it is terrifyingly wild to think we're on like some rock spending you know, 1,000 kilometers an hour, rotating around itself like 1,000 kilometers an hour with an atmosphere. Like, nothing's actually, like, nothing's tied to anything. It's just all gravity. It's the weakest fundamental force, just like holding all this shit together. And we're going tens of thousands of kilometers an hour through space, spinning around this giant. Giant, you know.
I wonder if that theory ever got. I remember reading a theory about gravity and why it was so much weaker than the other forces, like the strong, weak, nuclear, and magnetic. Yeah. And one of the theories was that the parallel worlds idea, and that gravity is actually a force that's felt along all of the different parallel worlds, and that's why it's weaker because it's divided amongst every one of them.
Yeah, so there's a great experiment they did with this. I think it's kind of pissa that they basically open a faucet and they have a faucet go into a glass. All right, and then they stick a trough, travels along one more dimension, so now it's two-dimensional,
mm-hmm.
X and Y, and obviously it fills up slightly differently. And then they did a plane, so a third dimension. They laid a plane down, had the water hit that, and you notice there's more glazed effects,
right?
Which makes it weaker. I mean, it is crazy if you think about it. Like, we can just, like, pick up a cell phone. Like, that's so weird.
I know. Violate the laws of gravity every day.
Yeah, right? It's so cool. No, I mean, I always joke, like, if I was smarter, I'd love to be like a scientist. I'd be like a physicist. It must be.
Yeah, I just they have to write reports, and I just hated writing. Like, that was the thing that held me back.
And they make no money.
Yeah, yeah, I know. Yeah. Unless you want to go work for like a big pharmaceutical company.
Yeah, right. Like, I have friends with PhDs in physics, and I'm just like, I always say to them, I'm like, dude, just go work in finance. You're good enough with money. Right. Like, you're good enough with math. Just go like. I don't know, build fucking robots in your backyard. Like, I don't know, like, what physicists do. Like, That's the weird thing about economics. Like, one, you know, I talk to a lot of kids on this stuff, and I'm like, you know, economics is one of the only engineering fields. It's like economics and nursing are the only non-engineering fields in the top 15, 20 highest paid degrees. I mean, sometimes econ's the highest paying degree, depending on, you know, how the metrics of the study. And I always say, like, economics is a weird beast because engineers are better at math than us. Like, they are better at math than us. We use a lot of the same math. Like, to the average Joe, we're all equal at math. Like, we're all, you know, because we all get that base calc too. Once you get to calc two, you're kind of like, you're never really going to see, unless you're specifically in a field, you're never really going to see somebody using something beyond calc two. But like, a lot of my friends, because where I went to college, are, you know, aerospace engineers, and they use calc three all day long. And like, in economics, you know, you get to calc two, then you really get to like kind of really high end econometrics and probabilistic statistics. So we kind of go the opposite directions there. But the average Joe, I mean, come on, like the average Joe, calculus is Greek to them. So you get to calc two, you don't really do
it. That's a good joke.
And all right. So I talk to people, and when, you know, they talk about different degrees, I always tell people going to economics, but I said economics, we always kind of feel bizarre. I talk to my friends in econ, where it's like, you know, you look at that chart of the highest paying people, and it's engineers and nursing. It's like engineers, nursing, and then obviously medicine's different because like you're going to professional, that those schedules change, which is like bachelor's and master's degrees. And we're the only guy up there, the only degree up there that has that little tinge of philosophy. So that's why I think we're all real weirdos, is because we were basically like, I really like history and philosophy, but I want to own a house.
Yes.
And be able to feed myself. Yes. So I'm going to learn math.
I don't want to teach.
Yeah, right. So you end up sitting in a calc class beside like some dude who's like going to be building rockets for the military, and like, you're like, I got to learn this calculus so I can look at a weird database.
Right.
But then go home and be like, let me get in some bizarre argument on like
on Reddit
whether or not the U.S. should build chips here. It's like potato chips or computer chips. Honestly, I'm up for either discussion.
All right. Well, I think we're probably going to have to wrap it up for this episode here. Big thank you to everyone stuck around to the end. Special thank you to Eric here for mixing in some valuable insights sandwiched between those eloquent digressions. Make sure you check out theinformaleconomist.com if you want to see more of Eric's work. If you have any more questions about what's covered today, email or DM them to us, and we'll be sure to answer them in the next installment. We'll be back in your ear canal soon like a Venetian gondola, but until then, share, subscribe your way with us to the top of the charts, and have a great day.
Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
This podcast is intended for informational and educational purposes only, does not constitute financial or investment advice, and should not be construed as such. The hosts, guests, and contributors of this podcast are not licensed financial advisors, brokers, or professionals. Any trading or investment decisions made based on the content of this podcast are solely at the listener's discretion and risk. Trading and investing in financial markets carry inherent risks, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Listeners should conduct their own research and seek advice from qualified financial professionals before making any financial decisions. The views, opinions, and information shared in this podcast are those of the individual contributors and do not necessarily reflect the views or policies of the podcast creators or associated organizations. Produced by China Shop Productions.
The Venetian Gato.
Yeah, so there's a place here called La Gondola. And that's how everyone pronounces it, gondola. And we're the only people in Illinois who try to correct people and say, no, it's a gondola. It's La Gondola. Not La Gondola.
They're just like, what?
there's a bunch of places here that just have some really weird pronunciations. Like Chillicothe is another weird one. I'll have to go find some more examples and send them to you.
Future Kyle here with a quick warning. Things are about to go off the rails, so if you choose to end the episode here, don't blame you. Otherwise, stick around.